I would like to thank you for the opportunity you gave to our family to be here with you this weekend, something we've been looking forward to. In fact, I think there were several occasions in the past where, on one occasion or another, we were talking about the possibility of being here to share, and for one reason or another, it did not work out. So we were looking forward to this weekend and certainly appreciated your hospitality and what we see here. You know, there's something unique about fellowshipping with God's children. Now, I can fellowship with a neighbor or someone that I've known for years and not really feel too much of a kinship with that person. And yet you can get together with God's people, someone that you've never met before, and you have a common bond. And there's just something special about that. And I just want to bless you in your lives, your work here in this community, and pray that God would continue to bless you and reach out to others through you as you continue to serve Him and live for Him here. I enjoyed the singing here. I enjoy singing. I enjoy the testimony of song. And one song here this afternoon that as we sang it, I just found myself stopping singing, thinking about the words, the message, and enjoying the music of the song. And it was a prayer. And I'd like to repeat that song again, "Breathe on Me, Breath of God," just as a prayer for this message and for our lives. And I trust that you were already thinking of the message of that prayer as you were praying it in song earlier. "Breathe on me, breath of God, fill me with life anew, that I may love what thou dost love and do what thou wouldst do. Breathe on me, breath of God, until my heart is pure, until with thee I will, one will, to do and to endure. Breathe on me, breath of God, till I am wholly thine, until this earthly part of me glows with thy fire divine. Breathe on me, breath of God, so shall I never die, but live with thee the perfect life of thine eternity." And I just feel like that song expresses my desire and our desire this weekend to become one with God and allow Him to minister through us here. Final message this afternoon, I'd like to share a message which I'm entitling "Climbing Together." In the first message on Friday evening, as we looked about the redwood trees, part of that message, one point of it, was in supporting each other in our Christian lives and Christian growth. And I mentioned that evening that that I'd like to look a little bit more at that subject, climbing together. We're going to look a little bit at climbing mountains as an illustration, but then focus on the brotherhood aspect and the need to climb together and work together and be together in that effort, not an individual effort. Back in 1917, there was a Catholic priest who was known as Father Flanagan, and he rented an old, dilapidated Victorian mansion in Omaha, Nebraska, with the intent of providing a home for orphan boys and mistreated boys. And his belief was that every boy needed to be given a chance in life, regardless of his background, regardless of the trouble he may have been in. And within a few months, there were 100 boys living in that home. Some were sent there by the courts, some were dropped off by concerned people, some were simply abandoned on the doorstep. A few wandered in on their own because they had no place to go. And this home continued to grow and eventually became known as Boys Town. Some of you may have heard that. During the first year of operation, there was a young boy by the name of Howard who had been abandoned by his mother and left at the doorstep of this home. Howard had polio and had great difficulty walking, especially when it came to going up and down steps or uneven terrain. It was very difficult for him to get around. And the other boys at the home took a liking to Howard, And sometimes they would be seen carrying him around to help him out because he had difficulty getting around. And as the story goes, one day they were at a picnic and Father Flanagan met a boy named Reuben carrying Howard on his back at this picnic. And he asked Reuben, "Isn't it hard work carrying your friend like that?" And Reuben's response was, "He ain't heavy, Father. He's my brother." And that slogan became, or that quote became a slogan, along with the image of those two boys, became the well-known trademark for Boys Town for many years. "He ain't heavy, Father. He's my brother." I'd like to ask, are you willing to carry your brother? You see, God did not design us to be solitary creatures or lone rangers or the macho, "I can handle this myself" type of person. God designed us to function with others. He designed us to be part of a team, part of a group, part of a family, part of a community, and part of a church. And I find it interesting that even in Eden's pristine setting, in the Garden of Eden, sin had not entered the world. There was no guilt at that point. There was no discouragement. There was no fear, no sickness, no bills, no problems. Even in that setting, God looked down at Adam and said, "It's not good for a man to be alone." And he created a wife. And so doing ensured that throughout the remainder of time, there would be people to relate together. I'd like to tell another story this morning to emphasize this point as well. This story is also a true story about a man by the name of Aaron Ralston. Aaron Ralston is a hiker and a well-known mountain climber with quite a few accomplishments to his name. He has climbed in various areas, various places, and faced a number of challenges. One of the goals that he met was to reach the highest peak in each of the 50 states. Of course, the most challenging would be Mount McKinley in Alaska, over 20,300 feet tall, a very challenging climb. He was also the first person to reach all of the peaks in Colorado that exceed 14,000 feet. There's quite a few of them, to reach the peak of all of these mountains in the wintertime alone. He set that challenge for himself and he met that challenge. One bright Saturday in May of 2003, nice spring day, Aaron set out on what he anticipated to be a rather simple excursion. The challenge, in his opinion, was not near as great as some of the challenges he had faced before that. He expected that he would complete this excursion in 8 hours. He drove out into a wilderness area in Utah and headed into a remote area there to climb a narrow gorge known as Blue John Canyon. And this was a narrow gorge at some places only 3 feet wide from the one wall to the other. And he was planning to rappel down through this gorge from the top down through the bottom and then hike out through the gorge and return home again. And as he was lowering himself down through this gorge, he came to a point there where there was a big boulder wedged between the two walls of the canyon. And as he was lowering himself past that boulder, the boulder shifted and trapped his arm between the boulder and the wall of the canyon. And there was nothing he could do to free himself from this boulder, which was later estimated to weigh 800 pounds, but even more than that, it was wedged between the walls of that canyon. Fortunately, there was a small ledge there on which he could place his feet to support himself. And from that position, he pulled, he pushed, he pried, he tried to do everything he could. But there he was, trapped 60 feet above the floor of the canyon and 8 miles from his pickup. The day passed, the night came, and even though it was springtime, the nights were quite chilly and frosty. He shivered through the night. He rationed his water, trying to make it last as long as he could. Another night passed, another day. another night, another day. And on the third day, Aaron assumed that more than likely, this is where I'm going to die. And he had a small knife, one of these little multi-tools, like a little pliers, knife combination, so forth. And in the wall, in the rock, in the wall of that canyon, he carved his name and the date of his birth and the date that he assumed he may die. Now, there's one outstanding problem with this story, and you probably know what it is. Aaron was climbing alone. And there was not a single person on the face of the earth that had any idea where he was. No one knew where to look for him. This happened on a Saturday. And it wasn't until Tuesday when he missed work for the second day in a row that anyone even missed him. I assume he must have been living alone. So people started looking for him, but they had no idea where to look. If he would have been hiking with a companion, the story would have a drastically different ending than what it does. The title of the sermon I mentioned is Climbing Together. As Christians, God never intended for us to climb alone. He intended us to climb together. I invite you to open your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 4. And I'm going to read a passage here that sometimes we associate with weddings. Because it says two are better than one. But nowhere in this passage does it refer to the man and wife relationship. I think what this passage, even though it may apply very well to weddings, I have no problem with that. But I think the real context of this passage is brotherhood, brothers relating together, sisters relating together, helping each other. And I'd like to use this passage as the text and look at some ways in which we, as brothers and sisters in Christ, need to climb together and work together. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 9. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. Again, if two lie together, then they have heat. But how can one be warm alone? And if one prevail against him, two shall withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. I'd like to look at this passage and pick out five aspects of brotherhood that I think we need to develop in our lives as we relate together as a brotherhood. The passage starts out saying, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. What is the reward for their labor? These two rather than one. One aspect of that reward is simply the fact that they can support and encourage each other. They can give affirmation. And that is the first point. The first aspect of brotherhood is affirmation. Just simply being there to encourage your brother. It says they have a reward. It doesn't say he, the one, or the other, but they, as they're working together as a team. It's not a matter to see what one person can accomplish, what he can get out of it. It's a plural perspective, not a singular perspective. And I can imagine that as Aaron Ralston was stuck there in the wall of that canyon with his arm trapped behind that boulder, that he would have given anything he had to just simply have one person there beside him to look at him and say, Aaron, we're going to get you out of here. Hang in there. We're going to make this. Just don't give up. That kind of affirmation could have done wonders in that situation. I'm not a long distance runner. If I start running, I tucker out pretty quickly. But I enjoy watching people run. And long distance running particularly fascinates me. When I lived in Canada, we lived in a a setting way out in the bush, quite a distance from any town, at a boys' high school, Sterling Lake High School. And there was one dirt road leading to this school. 50 miles down the road, there was another high school for the girls. 50 miles away, it was the closest neighbors. And every spring, the school had a track and field event, and they had some races. They had, I think, a 5-kilometer race and a 10-kilometer race. And the one spring, there were some people there that were pretty enthusiastic about running. And they said, why don't we do a marathon? See if we can do a marathon. 26 miles. And they were talking about this. And they, as they were entertaining the idea, someone said, well, you know what? If we run 26 miles, that is more than half the way to the girls' school. Why don't we just run the whole way while we're at it and make a 50-mile race? And the more they talked about this, the more they became intrigued with the idea. And it was basically not a race against each other, but the race against the impossibility. And they were just determined to see if they could actually do this. So quite a few people were committed to doing it. About the whole school participated in the beginning of the race. They ran for maybe a mile or so just to be a part of the effort, and then they came back. Quite a few of the boys, their only goal was to run 25.1 miles because 25 miles was a halfway point. And there was the understanding that if you fall out of the race in the first half, you get back brought back home. If you make it past the halfway point when you get picked up, you get taken on to the girls' school and you get to have some social time with the girls. So a lot of them, their only goal was to run 25.1 miles to make it past the halfway point. But there were a few who were determined to make this race, and they ran. And there were a number of them that completed it that year. I think it took them 13 hours. They hung together. It wasn't a race against each other. But the next race, the next year, they decided, we're going to do this again. And now it became a race against each other because they knew they could do it. Now it's going to become a competitive thing. And there were a few young boys there who were very determined, and one of them particularly spent a lot of time in running. And they left in the race for half a mile or a mile or so. They were together. And after that, he just took off. He set his own pace. He made that race in less than 10 hours, 9-point-some hours. But what a lot of those runners would do, they would have someone stationed maybe a mile from the end of the race to join them the last segment of the race and run beside them. When they had no energy left, someone to just run beside them and say, hang in there, you can do it. I'm right here. I'm with you. Don't give up. You can't stop. You're almost there. And that person would be the person that would help to carry them over the finish line. You know, that runner that accompanied the person who was racing, he could not actually transfer physical energy into his friend's legs. He could not make the finish line come any closer, but he could give the encouragement, the affirmation. You made it so far. I know you can do it. Just keep on running. And together they would finish that race. That's what the affirmation is all about in the Christian life. Looking at your friend and say, friend, you've come too far. Don't stop now. You've got to keep going. I can see the end. Jesus is waiting. Don't give up now. I heard another illustration, and again, I don't have any experience working with horses. Some of you probably have considerable experience with horses, but I've had people who worked with horses affirm this account. And the story that I heard was of a horse pulling contest where they see what horse can pull the heaviest load. And according to the story, in this particular contest, the horses were not pulling in teams, but they were pulling individually. And in this particular contest, the winning horse pulled 5,000 pounds of weight, and the runner-up horse pulled 4,500 pounds. And someone got the idea, let's put these two horses together and see how much they can pull together. So remember, the one pulled 5,000 pounds, the other pulled 4,500. So they put these weights together, come up with 9,500 pounds, hooked the horses to it, and they just walked off with it, almost without effort. So they kept adding weight and more weight, and these two horses ended up pulling together 12,000 pounds before they were at the end, because there was a teamwork effort. A word that describes that situation is synergy, which simply means that the effort of two forces combined is greater than their individual efforts combined. You put them together, they can do more than the sum of the parts. I referred to Barnabas, Paul and Barnabas, on Friday evening. And I think they're a beautiful example of this kind of affirmation. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul is giving somewhat of his testimony of his life. And he's looking back over his life and he's giving some of the most difficult experiences that he went through. He talks about being shipwrecked. He talks about being beaten. He talks about being stoned. And he talks about all these crises experiences he had. But I find it interesting what he ends that list with. Kind of goes on to some other thoughts and then he comes back. He says, oh, yes. And there's one other thing. I was left down over the wall of Damascus in a basket. He put that experience right there with all these other crises experiences. You see, at that point, Paul was a young Christian. He was a new Christian. And this was one of the first trials that he faced when the authorities were looking for him there. And he talks about that time when he went over the wall in a basket as one of the main things he remembers as he looks back in his life. And I can understand that. I mean, after all, how would you like to be halfway down the wall in a basket if there's no one holding on to the ropes? It would be a letdown experience, literally. And he was referring to the support he got from his brothers when he was left down over the wall. He said, those brothers were there holding on to the ropes. They were supporting me. They were encouraging me. Well, then what happened? Paul ran for his life. These men helped him escape one of the first crises in his life as a servant of God. He was talking about it the rest of his life. Well, he escaped, and he finally made it back to Jerusalem. Now, picture yourself in Paul's situation. A young Christian, you had just realized who Jesus is, what he means to you, his calling in your life to serve him. You're running for your life. The authorities are out to get you. You're looking forward to getting to Jerusalem where the Christians are, where the believers are, these people that you have recently joined, and you're looking forward to being received by them. And you get into Jerusalem, and all these Christians look at you with raised eyebrows. What are you doing here? I know who you are. I know what you're up to. They didn't receive him either. The authorities were after him. Here he comes to the Christians, and the Christians didn't receive him. They were scared of him. Then comes Barnabas on the scene. And I can just kind of picture what happens. As Barnabas walks up to Paul, puts his arm on his shoulder, and he walks over to Peter, and he says, Peter, I'd like to introduce my friend to you. I'd like to let him tell you about his meeting with Jesus. Then he walks over to John. John, I'd like you to meet Paul. He is a new believer. I'd like you to hear his testimony. And he goes on from one to another, until Paul is received into that group, because one person was there to affirm him. One person was there to stand beside him. One person was there to give him his support. It's a high calling to help others succeed. Make it your goal to affirm your brothers. Look beyond the surface. Not just a casual, how are you doing this morning? How was your week? Look beyond what they say. Look for ways to support your brother. Look for ways to encourage your sister. Look for ways to be there when they need you, to give them the hand that they need. So the first thing, first characteristic of brotherhood is affirmation. Secondly, verse 10 says, for if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. I think Aaron Ralston should have read this passage before he left on that hike that morning. Woe to him that is alone when he falleth. You know, the benefit for him, if he would have had someone else with him, is so obvious. Just one other person there with the mobility to move about that was not trapped. Someone with two strong arms, someone that wasn't trapped, someone with the freedom to move about could probably have found a pole or something to pry that boulder off his arm. If not, he could certainly have gone for help, and the help would probably have arrived before the day was over. He could have offered him food. He could have offered him a coat. He could have offered him water. He could have offered to try and build a fire there or something. But he was alone. He had no one to give any assistance. Now, when we're climbing in the Christian life, I told you last evening, it's inevitable that we will be in the desert. And it's also inevitable that we will fall, because we are human. Every one of us is going to fall sometimes. Every one of your brothers and sisters is going to fall. Now, what is your response when your brother falls? He should have known better. I saw it coming. He should have listened. If only he'd have listened to my advice, he could have avoided that. Or do we walk up behind him, beside him, put our arm in his shoulder and say, "Brother, I'm here to help you. We're going to get you out of here. Let me give you a hand. If we work at this together, I'm sure we can get out of this predicament." And I say it's inevitable that we're going to fall. And I'm not talking only about falling into sin. Yes, we do fall into sin. But I'm talking about falling into discouragement. Sometimes we simply become discouraged. We may fall into loneliness, just feeling alone where we are. Fall into the pit of low self-esteem. I'm just not worth much. What can I contribute? Do we step up beside that brother and say, "I'm glad for what you have to offer"? Sometimes there's just simply falling into weariness, overwhelmed with life. There's health issues. You know what that means. You're facing some of those. You have faced some of those. Are we there to support our sister, our brother, put our arm around her, put our arm around him, and say, "I'm here to help you through this. We're going to survive"? Sometimes we may fall into financial difficulties. Maybe we made some bad decisions. Maybe we did not make bad decisions, but just facing a difficult time. Are we there to give assistance? And I think again of Aaron and Hur standing beside Moses as he was there on that mountainside, on that hillside overlooking the valley. And the thing that stands out to me, and I think I mentioned this the other evening, is that Moses knew what he needed to do. He needed to keep his arms upraised so that his people could experience a victory. He knew what he needed to do, but he simply lacked the strength to do it. And sometimes in life, we know what we need to do. We know what God wants of us, but we just simply lack the strength to do it. And what we need is a brother on our side, a sister on our side, someone to support our hands and say, "I'm going to spend some time in prayer with you. I'm going to help you through this. We're going to survive." And as we do that, everyone is a winner. God may not be asking you to be a Paul, an Apostle Paul. God may not be asking you to be a Moses. He may be asking you to be a Barnabas or an Aaron or a Hur, just someone that is willing to simply stand there and give assistance to your brother and to your sister. Move on to the next point. Verse 11, again, "If two lie together, then they have heat. But how can one be warm alone?" First, when I looked at this verse, wasn't sure what the application should be here. But then I got to thinking of warming one another, cold, experiencing cold. In the wintertime, young people, brothers and sisters, have you ever had your brother, your sister come in from the cold, walk up behind you, reach around you and put his cold fingers on your cheek or your neck? What's your response? "Get your cold hands off of me," right? "Get out of here. I don't like your cold hands. You see, there's something about that person that we don't like to accept, something that we find repulsive. The third aspect of brotherhood is acceptance. It says, if two lie together, they have heat. Now, who likes to be against a cold person? It's not pleasant, but there needs to be acceptance, accepting one another. Now, there may be characteristics about a person that need to be changed. And there may be characteristics that we just need to accept. But at any rate, we need to accept the person for who they are. Sometimes it's most difficult to accept the people closest to us. People that we have certain similarities with, but they just don't quite measure up. A number of you have asked me this weekend, "You're a bang. Where do you come from?" And over the lunchtime, Daniel was asking me, "So you grew up in a Mennonite setting. You're now with a Beachy setting. How does that work? What do you see in the differences?" And sometimes when we're these two different groups of people, we just kind of, you know, scrape against each other. We meddle against each other. Do we accept one another? You know, the way I grew up, by the way, was the normal way, right? The way you grew up was the normal way. Every one of us tends to evaluate everyone else by our own experience, because my experience is the norm. Well, what about this other person's experience? Are we willing to accept his background? Are we willing to accept that person for who he is as you relate to the community around you? And I think of an example there. I think of Ruth and her willingness to accept Naomi's culture as her own. She showed a tremendous commitment to acceptance. And in that commitment, she said, "Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people. Thy God, my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried." A commitment to the end. Now, these were two entirely different cultures, a pagan culture and a godly culture. But there was an acceptance and a love that is beautiful as you read that story. So I encourage you, as you relate to brothers and sisters, keep your eyes open for those aspects in your brother or your sister that feel like a cold hand on your cheek, and determine to accept that cold hand and not pull away from it. And that takes us up to the next point. If two lie together, they have heat, but how can one be warm alone? The next point is abandonment. Suppose someone walks up to you, behind you, puts a freezing cold hand against you. Instead of jumping away, you turn to that person and you say, "You have cold hands. Here, let me take your hand in mine. I want to warm your hands. They're cold. That has to hurt." And you take their hand and you warm their hands for them. Now, what happens? As you do that, you are transferring heat from your hands to their hands. So in giving them comfort, you are abandoning some of your own comfort, right? You're giving your comfort to comfort them. Abandonment. Just giving up yourself. I can imagine going back to that setting where Aaron Ralston was trapped along the wall of that canyon. If any one of you would have been hiking through that area and would have come across him, I'm guessing you would have been willing to take off your coat and throw it over his shoulders. "You must be cold. Here, let me give you my coat." You would have been willing to give him the last drop of water in your water bottle if he had been there for days without water. You would have been willing to give him your food. You would have been willing to abandon your agenda for the day, your goal where you wanted to go, and say, "I'm going to go get help for you. We're going to get you out of here." See, you would have abandoned pretty much anything you had for him at that point, simply to help him in a physical way. What about when you meet a brother or a sister that needs your help. If you could have gotten Aaron freed from that rock, you would have probably even taken him dirty, sweaty, bloody, perhaps. You would have taken him in your vehicle and taken him to a hospital or wherever he needed to get help. When you bump into a dirty situation with your brother and your sister, do you shy away from it? I don't want to get involved in that. That looks a little bit too much. Or are you willing to abandon your comfort and get involved and get your hands dirty? The Good Samaritan is a beautiful example of that. I think I'm going to read that account in Luke 10. And as I read this account, I don't want you to think necessarily of a man, a certain man, that is abandoned along the road somewhere between Jerusalem and Jericho. I want you to think of somebody that you know that you tend to pull away from, that you tend to find repulsive, that you tend to find to be just a little bit dirty, something about him that irritates you. And look at this response. Luke chapter 10, verse 30. A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, which stripped him of his raiment and wounded him and departed, leaving him half dead. Personally, I don't find that very appealing. And by chance, there came down a certain priest that way, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. And likewise, a Levite, when he was at the place, came and looked on him and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was. And when he saw him, he had compassion on him. And he abandoned his goals for the day and went to him, bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and abandoning his own ride, set him on his own beast, and brought him to an inn, and took care of him. And on the morrow, when he departed, he abandoned his money, took out 2 pence, and gave them to the host, and said unto him, take care of him, and whatsoever thou spendest more, when I come again, I will repay thee. Your brother is by the wayside. There's something about him that you find repulsive. Are you willing to abandon yourself for him? Jesus' last words in this account, go and do thou likewise. Look for ways to abandon your comfort, your interest, and your pleasure for the sake of your brother, for the sake of his survival. The last characteristic of climbing together that I see in this passage, we'll find in verse 12, and it says, if one prevail against him, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Now, this verse talks about someone coming against you, okay? It talks about an enemy. It talks about facing the enemy. What do we need from our friends to help us face the enemy? Now, every one of these things that I mentioned before, assistance, affirmation, accountability, abandonment, and so forth, will help him face. But the point I'd like to bring out here is that of accountability. Benjamin Franklin is known for the statement, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And accountability is that of helping your brother or your sister be prepared to face the enemy, to withstand him, and come away victorious. And again, I think back to Aaron Ralston. If he would have had a friend with him that was willing to hold him accountable, a friend that could have said, Aaron, stop. I don't like what I see, that rock, where you're headed, the route you're taking. It looks too precarious. It's too dangerous. I don't want you to go there. I want you to go over here instead. That kind of accountability could have made a tremendous difference in his life. You've probably all heard the expression, friends don't let friends drive drunk. It's the idea of accountability. Some people like to twist that around a little bit and say, friends don't let friends drive Chevys. You know, if you value your life, drive something more trustworthy, or you can put in there whatever you want to. It's a matter of accountability, holding someone responsible for their decisions. Brothers, don't let brothers endanger their spiritual lives. We look at them, look where they're headed. Brother, stop. You're spending too much time on the job. You have a family, you have a wife, you have children. They need you. You're not at home enough. You need to spend more time at home. You need to plan a different route where you have more time at home. Perhaps you look at your brother or your sister and say, stop. Are you really sure you want to go that deep into debt? Are you sure God is leading you into this? How is this going to affect your availability for God's work? How is this going to affect your service for Him? How is this going to affect your Christian testimony? You may notice your brother and you may need to say, stop. I see some tensions developing between you and this other brother. And I don't think you're headed on the right path. I think you need to consider where you're going. I think you need to choose another route. It's affecting your relationship with Christ. It's affecting your Christian testimony. You need to resolve this problem before it becomes bigger. And there's any number of areas in which we may look at our brother and our sister, and we may need to tell them that they need to stop. And there are any number of ways in which we need to accept the counsel of our brothers and sisters when they look at our lives. I think it's for good reason that this point is listed as the last point in this series. You see, you can't just jump into someone's life and start telling them what to do and expect them to appreciate it. But if that brother has received your affirmation, if that brother has received your assistance, your acceptance, if he has sensed that you are willing to abandon yourself for his sake, he will be more inclined to accept it when you hold him accountable for his actions. Accountability recognizes the third entity. This verse says, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. You see, accountability does not hold a brother accountable just to me. It's not a matter of saying, I don't like what you're doing, but it's holding him accountable to God. It recognizes the third aspect of God's presence. That's what brotherly relationship will do. As I think of accountability, an example of that from the scripture, I think of the life of David. The prophet Nathan came to David after he fell into sin with Bathsheba, and he held David accountable. And there's two things I notice about Nathan's response to David. First of all, he came with tact. He didn't just simply walk up to him and look at him and say, brother, you blew it. But he engaged him in conversation and he started telling him a story. And he got David's attention and he got his sympathies aroused and he got David's emotions involved. And then he came out with a bluntness. He didn't beat around the bush. He said, David, you are the man. You are the one that did this. He did not spare the punches. And he held him accountable, not simply to himself. He didn't say, I don't like what you did. He held him accountable to God. And David's words, his response was, I have sinned against God. Now, when we're talking about climbing together, you know, David had a dear friend, David and Jonathan, two friends that were closer than a brother. And someone has surmised, and we really do not know this, but you remember how Jonathan was killed. He was no longer alive at this point. Someone surmised that if Jonathan would have still been alive, his relationship with David would have been close enough that probably David would not have fallen into sin with Bathsheba, because Jonathan would have been there and he would have seen the tendencies that were developing in David's life, perhaps when he was sitting back in the palace when his armies were out in war. And Jonathan would have held him accountable and could have prevented him from entering into that sinful relationship. We don't know that. That's surmising. But I find that thought challenging. When my brother or my sister falls into sin, into discouragement, whatever it is, Is it because I have not been there? Because my presence has been missing in his life? Together is better. So many examples in the scripture. Together is better. Climbing together. God does not expect you to reach the mountain peaks alone. Jesus knew that together was better. Why did Jesus choose 12 disciples? I'm sure there are numerous reasons, but I find it interesting that Mark chapter 3, Mark says, "And he ordained 12 that they should be with him." Jesus knew that together was better. When Jesus went up on the Mount of Transfiguration, when he went into the garden to pray, he took disciples with him. He knew that together was better. Paul knew that together was better. He did not travel alone. He traveled with Timothy, with Silas, with Titus, with John Mark, with Barnabas. And it seems, if you look at the scripture closely, that Paul was so convinced that together is better, that if he did not have someone to travel with him, he simply did not go. Look closely at 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. He said, "Furthermore, when I came to Troas to preach Christ's gospel, and a door was opened unto me of the Lord, I had not rest in my spirit because I found not Titus, my brother. So I left from there and went into Macedonia." He didn't have a brother to go with him. There was an opportunity there, but he knew that he needed someone with him. And if you think that you are better than Jesus, if you are better than Paul, and you can go it alone, you're setting yourself up for a fall. Perhaps you're wondering what happened to Aaron Ralston. We left him back there in the canyon, trapped 60 feet above the canyon floor, 8 miles away from his truck, with no one knowing where he was. 5 days passed, and Aaron finally concluded that if I'm going to get out of here, it's up to me. And if I'm going to get out of here, I'm going to resort to some pretty drastic measures. And on the fifth day, he decided that he's going to amputate his arm to free himself. So he managed to pry himself against that rock until he broke both of the bones in his forearm. And then he took his knife and he started cutting. And he cut through the flesh till he got to the tendons. And his knife was too dull from scraping on the rocks to cut through the tendons. So he took his pliers and snipped them off. And he described the moment that he fell free from that rock as the happiest moment of his life. He said that in retrospect. I doubt if he said it at the moment. But his ordeal was still far from over. He still needed to rappel 60 feet down to the floor of that canyon with one arm, which he managed to do. He still had 8 miles to hike back to his truck in the midday sun. He started hiking toward his truck. He only had one more mile to go when he finally met some other hikers who gave him some water, gave him some food, were able to contact some emergency personnel, and he was flown out by helicopter to a hospital, and he survived the ordeal. But today, he has one arm, because he chose to walk alone. It changed the rest of his life. What is your choice? Is your choice to walk alone, or is your choice to walk together? Sometimes we are a Howard. Remember that boy with polio? We need to be carried. We need to accept the help of our brothers and allow them to lift us up and carry them along. Sometimes we are a Reuben, the boy who was carrying Howard. We have something to offer, and we need to abandon our own ambitions in order to step in and help our brother along the way. Many times we may be a Reuben and a Howard at the same time. It's a give and take relationship. As we help our brother, we find out that we ourselves are being helped. But never does God ask us to be an Aaron. Never does God ask us to walk this journey alone. That's the beauty of a church. That's the beauty of this group that is here gathered together. We're here to walk together. We're here to climb together. We're here to offer that assistance, that affirmation, and that accountability as is necessary. I would like to close this message and this weekend with one more illustration. The title of our message this morning, I said, is Climbing Together. And the emphasis was climbing together as a brotherhood. But I'd like to close with a challenge to climb with God and to walk with God. And I'm going to share experience that I had some years ago. While I was living in Romania, I became quite sick with hepatitis. And the doctor who was caring for me there told me later that it was the worst case of hepatitis he ever saw. And he did not tell me this when I was in the middle of it, but he did tell me afterwards that he wasn't sure I was going to pull through. And so during that time, there were weeks on end where about all I could do was watch the ceiling as I was on my back. And had a lot of, you know, just laying around, restless nights. Of course, you're not doing anything during the day. And during that time, one night, I had a dream. And I'm generally not one to put a lot of stock on dreams. I don't really think we should look at dreams as a direction for life. But this particular dream was a dream that I did find encouraging and challenging. And I'm going to try to relate to you what I saw in that dream. Now, I know I cannot totally succeed in doing that, in giving you the mental image that I experienced in that dream. But in this particular dream that I dreamed, I was a tour guide for a busload of tourists. And we were not touring Lancaster County. We were touring a mountain area. This was an extremely rugged mountain area. And we were driving in this bus along this narrow mountain road. And on the one side, it was almost straight up. On the other side, it was almost straight down. And we were just crawling along this road on the bus. And we got to a point on this road where we stopped. And I started addressing the people in the bus. And I said, if you look out the window here to your side, you'll notice there's a little narrow footpath that winds back and forth down the side of this mountain. That path goes the whole way down to the valley. And this valley is absolutely the most gorgeous, outstandingly beautiful place anywhere on earth. You have never seen beauty anywhere like what you can see in this valley. And I said, my intention is to lead you down this path so that you can experience the beauty of this valley. But there was a problem. Just before we had gotten there, there had been this tremendous thunderstorm, this gushing downpour, and that little narrow path that was barely wider than your foot was pure slime and mud and just a sheer drop-off. On the other side, it looked absolutely impossible. But somehow in my dream, I knew that I could lead this load of tourists down that path safely. And so I told them, I said, now I know to you, it looks absolutely impossible to walk that path. It looks like it's not even part of the question, no question about it. But I said, I can assure you that if you walk it, if you follow me, you will get to your destination safely. And I can assure you that when you reach that destination, you will be so glad you took that trip because the beauty there will be more than worth it. But at the same time, I said, I know that it looks impossible. So it's up to you. I'm going to allow you to make the decision. Do you want to go or do you want to pass? And the dream was over. And I woke from that dream, and I felt that God was specifically speaking to me and saying, Nate, I have a path picked out for you, a path that looks absolutely impossible for you to walk. And I am leaving the decision up to you. Do you want to walk this path? If you choose to take my hand and walk this path, I can guarantee your safety. But at the same time, if you choose not to walk this path, I understand and I will accept that. It's up to you. And I was just so gripped by that thought. And I was so gripped by it that I didn't want to forget it. And I didn't want to forget that picture. And I didn't want to forget that challenge. And so I tried to capture that experience in a poem. Now, I never really considered myself that much of a poet, but I would like to share with you, as a closing challenge, the poem that I wrote that I felt was God's challenge to me at that time. And I just want to pass that on to you. The title is Come Walk With Me. The path is steep into the vale, and dark and muddy too. The torrents fall, hard blows the gale, 'tis not a pleasant view. I cannot see where this trail leads, with narrow curves so tight. I think it cannot meet my needs, it disappears from sight. My legs are weary, my feet are tired, I do not wish to start. So sure I'll fall and become mired, I'm frightened in my heart. And then I hear my father say, in tones so calm and mild, I see beyond the mud and clay, where you see not, my child. For when you reach that valley deep, such beauty you'll behold, the peace that in your soul you reap cannot with words be told. The valleys spread with lush green glades. The sun in splendor glows. The sky is stretched with glorious shades a mortal seldom knows. The air is still, the water kind, reflecting trees and sky. Upon this earth you'll never find a nicer place to lie. If you accept this path so wild and this dark lonesome trip, I'll hold your hand in mine, my child. I will not let you slip. I'll walk before you all the way, wherever you must go. I'll lead you safely through that clay. No mishap shall you know. And when we reach that glorious dale, you'll have not one regret. You'll be so glad you walked that trail, worth every trial you met. The choice is yours, he says to me. You may remain behind. I'll take your pick, whatever it be. You must make up your mind. I gaze into my father's eye. I bow on bended knee. Can I such love as his defy? What will my answer be? Lord, I'll go with you all the way. Your will I can't decline. Oh, let me never from you stray. I'll take your hand in mine. Oh, thank you, Lord, that I may choose to in your will recline. I know with you I cannot lose. Your pathway is divine. And as I went through that experience, I assumed that God was referring to my illness. And I assumed that he was just simply asking me to accept the fact that I'm going through this illness. And at that point, I had no idea that that year was going to turn out to be the most difficult year of my entire life, as we faced challenges on the mission field that I never dreamed that I would face. And there were nights that I came home crying, Lord, I don't have anything more to give. I've given everything I have. I may as well just go home. There's no reason I stay here. And then I'd hear my father say, it's up to you. If you want to go home, I understand. You may do that. But I'm asking you to stay. I'm asking you to walk this path. I'm telling you that if you walk with me, I will hold your hand in mine, and I will not let you slip. And I think it was that message that carried me through that year, that encouragement from God. And I'd just like to leave that question with you today. As you think about your journey and your walk and your Christian life, whether you're in the wilderness or whether you're on the mountain, will you just accept the path that God chooses for you? You see, you have the power of choice, and you can walk out of this building and go your own way. Or you can tell God, I'm going to take your hand and walk with you wherever it goes, wherever you lead. Will you put your hand in His and walk with Him? I'd like if you would open your songbooks to number 570. Fully surrendered, Lord divine, I would be true to thee. All that I am or have, and may I add all that I'm not and all that I don't have, is thine. I will be true to thee. I'd like to ask you to stand. And if this song expresses the desire of your heart, join as we sing together. Fully surrendered, Lord.
I will be true to thee. thee.
Let's bow our heads for prayer.